Thanks so much for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. You know, we've had a lot of freezing and thawing this winter, and that kind of weather can lead to ice dams. And we're going to talk a little bit about ice dams today on the show today. And, of course, we'll take other home improvement topics as well with our two guests. Chad Spate back with us. He's the owner of Chad's Design Build. Chad, good to have you with us today.
Thanks, Larry. It's always great to be here.
And Emily Millar with us as well for the first time. She's a BPI certified home energy assessor and president of Steady State Building Performance. And Emily, thank you for joining us.
Larry, thank you so much for having me on the show. I'm excited.
Yeah, it's great to have you along. Well, so as you listen to these two experts talk, what would you like to know about keeping your roof free of ice dams? What other home repair questions do you have? I hope you'll give us a call. The number is 1-800-642-1234, or you can send us an email to ideas@wpr.org. And Emily, just to begin, you're a BPI certified home energy assessor. What does that all mean?
That's correct. So essentially what I like to describe myself as is somewhat of a home detective. People call me with all sorts of issues, from ice damming to indoor moisture to general stuffy air. The majority of what I perform are home energy assessments, which are a way to quantitatively determine how energy efficient your home is and the best way to prioritize improvements.
So you go in, essentially you're going into homes and testing them.
That is correct. The majority of the diagnostics that I do air leakage testing using something called a blower door, which is a way to depressurize your home and test how leaky it is. And I also do that in tandem with infrared imaging so that we can find those pesky air leaks while we have your home depressurized.
And Chad, how often do you use energy assessors like Emily in your work?
Well, Larry, we try to bring them in, Emily and others, when we are going through the process of planning for a major renovation, just to see what the baseline for the home is. So, you know, for example, we may be doing a kitchen renovation, but we want to know, you know, we're going to be putting maybe a larger exhaust fan above the stovetop. And so that's going to be introducing a new dynamic into the home. And so we want to know, how's this home performing prior to the renovation, so that we can be prepared to provide some additional makeup air if that's going to be needed. Or maybe our client, you know, has some of these concerns, and so we just want to bring in the professional that can do that testing so that we can help to fix these issues while we're doing whatever other improvements might be on the list for that homeowner.
Sounds a really useful thing for you and for the homeowner.
Absolutely. I like to use the analogy that, you know, when you go in for your annual physical, you know, the doctor is probably going to do some blood tests and some other analysis to find out, you know, how healthy you are, and to see if there are any other underlying conditions that they might want to take a more careful look at. And so that's kind of, you know, when you remodel your house, it's kind of like going in for surgery. And no one would go into surgery without, you know, checking the vital signs of a patient days prior to the operation to make sure that, you know, well, gee, we wouldn't want to do this given what we discovered in those tests, or we're going to take these extra precautions when we perform the surgery. And that's really how I look at it.
Pretty cool. You know, the first thing that comes to a lot of homeowners' minds, I'm sure, is how expensive is it to do an energy assessment? And maybe are there funds available to help offset costs?
Exactly. That's a great question. And in terms of cost, typically for a 3-hour diagnostic appointment, which includes a full report, that starts at about $325. And the upside benefit for the client in terms of going through the assessment process, if you are a qualified, if you have a qualified utility providing your heat, which the majority of Madison does, having natural gas, then you qualify for the Focus on Energy program. And currently, the incentives through that program are yielding clients an average of about $1,100 per project. So you can see that $325, exactly, yes, there's a lot of upside.
Well, let's, Chad, let's talk about ice dams for a minute. We have callers online with other questions, but is it the freezing and thawing that causes the ice dams in some homes?
Yeah, well, so ice dams can be complicated. There's not always an obvious explanation for them, but generally they're caused by heat escaping from the home and hitting the roof deck and causing the snow on the roof to melt. And then it goes down by way of gravity. And at the bottom of the roof, which often there's a little bit of an eave or an overhang, which is beyond where the heat is escaping. So that melted snow will refreeze and then start to slowly build up ice beyond where the heat is. And that's why we call it an ice dam, because, you know, water or any liquid will follow the laws of gravity and try to make its way off of a roof. And if it freezes, then that's creating a blockage, and slowly that ice will build up and literally dam the other liquid on the roof, and it just becomes a block of ice down at the bottom. And so often the solution for that is to do a better job of insulating and air sealing above the exterior wall of the home, which is often the trickiest part to insulate because there's less space there. And then any place that heat is escaping into the attic will contribute to this problem. So that's where Emily's diagnostics come into focus for us, because they will show us where these problems are so that we can make sure that we go right to the problem, you know, instead of having to speculate as to where is this heat escaping. Sometimes, though, I would just add that you can have, you know, the orientation of the home can be a contributor. So you might have a combination of snow drifting due to the predominant wind direction on a home combined with the sun exposure that you're getting that's causing some melting at certain times of the day. And then we can see some ice damming from things like that. And another culprit can be the ventilation ductwork that's often on a roof. You know, bath fans and other fans often will vent out of a roof deck. And there you actually are intentionally exhausting hot, moist air out of the house. And that will often, you know, cause the snow around it to melt. And all other things being tight and well sealed and well insulated, that doesn't typically cause a problem, but sometimes it will cause a problem. So we will look at that as well.
Hmm. Cindy and Cable has something that relates to all this, I believe. Let's go there. Cindy, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi.
And
go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, what's on your mind? Go ahead.
We have a metal roof on our home, and we have two dormers, and the lower roof extends out past the dormers. And so that 410 pitch on the dormers, when the snow and ice build up on there, now as it's been getting warm and starting to slide off, we'll get very large pieces that will fall onto the lower roof line, and it's causing some big damage and dents in that. And I'm just wondering ways that we might be able to prevent that.
Hmm.
Yeah, so that's a great question, Cindy. And often, you know, metal roofing has the advantage of doing a good job of absorbing heat. You know, metal is a good conductor, and it's so when exposed to the sunlight, it'll heat up, and that will encourage the snow and ice to slide off of the roof. And so there are some things that can be installed on your roof to help prevent that from happening in the way that you describe, where large sheets are kind of falling off and potentially causing damage below. These are little often pieces of metal that are attached near the bottom of the roof that essentially protect or help reduce that from happening in a sudden kind of violent way that causes damage. And so you might consider having the roofing contractor install some of these little protective devices that will reduce that.
There you go. Thank you so much for that call, Cindy. Appreciate it. Linda in Mequon, we'll go to you next. Hi, Linda.
Hi. Thanks for having the program.
Sure.
My husband and I built our house 25 years ago, and about 12 years later, we discovered that because Tyvek hadn't been used, that all of the windows in our house needed to be replaced. Fortunately, insurance paid for it. The contractor, we felt, did a really good job. Now, 13 years after that, we have a two-story foyer with a cathedral window, and my husband noticed that there was some rot at the next to the front door. That's typical with the side lights and front door. And when we had a contractor come and open up the front, we saw that there was significant rot, as in it had started as soon as... So that front, the front of our house actually had to be replaced 13 years in after we built our house, because there was so much rot. We even had to have a sister joint put in. But now under this cathedral window again, there's a lot of rot. I mean, not as bad as the first time, but we've had several contractors out. They ran a water test. Pella came out to look at the window. The contractor that did the work appears to be willing to stand behind it, but seems confused about, everybody seems to be confused about what would have caused it, because they did put Tyvek on when they did all of the repair work. So where on earth do we go to try to find a solution so that this is taken care of?
Well, so that is a great question, and I'm sorry to hear about, how challenging and nerve-wracking I'm sure this is. There are a variety of things that could be contributing to this. So, for example, as I know you learned through the process of discovering you didn't have the Tyvek on your home, that material is there to keep the water that is hitting the house and hitting the windows from getting into the wood that's underneath it. And, back originally, houses would have tar paper on them, and now we use Tyvek and other materials like that. I'm sure the contractor that installed the windows when they were replaced did the proper flashing down at the bottom of the window in particular, which is called panning the sill, so that any water that gets through that window assembly is going to hit that panning at the bottom and get diverted out of the house onto the Tyvek or the tar paper or whatever is there, and again, keep the house from rotting. So if all of that was done properly, then we have to look at whether or not possibly some vapor is escaping from within the house. And this is where the work of Emily and other home performance professionals becomes really helpful to us, because if the house does not have a proper vapor barrier on the inside, sometimes we'll find that rot on the exterior of the home is actually caused by interior moisture getting through the wall, and then that warm, moist air escapes and hits a cold piece of exterior sheeting, and it condenses. And we recently have been involved in restoring a geodesic dome house in the Madison area, and we've seen this all over the place where, interior air has gone through the structure, hit the sheathing, and then condensed, and it was literally rotting the house from within. So sometimes the rot is actually due to a moisture and a vapor barrier problem. So that could be part of what's going on, and that also can be driven by the orientation of the house with respect to where the sun is hitting it and how the interior dynamics of the home drive air to, have more pressure on certain walls than others.
Mm.
And that has to do with the wind loads and things like that.
Emily, is that something you see in your practice often?
Exactly. So I have this saying whenever I set foot into a house, which is don't guess, test, because I can hypothesize all day long. But with a home like Linda's, I would kind of follow a diagnostic pattern where, first of all, as Chad was saying, I would test what we call the building envelope, which is making sure that we have a continuous pressure and vapor boundary throughout the house. And I would test that by doing a blower door test and then looking with an infrared camera for any inconsistencies in that vapor barrier. And then once I had taken the blower door test, I would also know how tight the home was and if we were having any ventilation deficits. I would then test all of our ventilation systems within the home to make sure that they were adequate, because the truth is we have the existence of moisture. We need to decide how to remediate that and determine whether current exhaust systems are adequate and move from there.
Chad Spade and Emily Millar, our guests today on the show as we talk about home improvement issues with them. We've gotten into ice dams a little bit, and now we're on windows, and there's a whole lot more I'm pretty sure we can be discussing with them throughout the show. So I hope you keep emailing and joining in. I'm Larry Mueller. Jill Nadeau, our producer. Tyler Ditter, our engineer. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Thanks so much for joining us as we talk home improvement with our two guests, Chad Spade of Chad's Design Build and Emily Millar, Certified Home Energy Assessor, President of Steady State Building Performance. Great to have both of them with us. And Emily, just to go back to Linda and Mequon, so you'd probably recommend her to have a home energy assessment before she even moved any further, perhaps.
Either that or just having a series of diagnostic tests performed. When we have complex issues with a home and someone may not be interested in going through the full assessment program, I do offer hourly diagnostics and put together a package of testing that will be most appropriate for that home and its issues.
Yeah, excellent. Well, another Linda, this one from Madison up next. Linda, hello.
Hi. My call. My question is about I'm going to be in an apartment that has been made very quite tight, insulated very well,
yeah.
And it will have electric heating, but I'm concerned about the airflow, and I'm wondering if there's something that you can do besides opening the windows all the time. Better airflow.
Sure. Well, so that's a great question. So when you have a house that is really well built, it will be extremely tight, and there will be very little air leakage that happens unless it's done with intention. And so there are particular appliances that we install into homes and that a builder will typically install, or a remodeler if they're making the house tighter, that will bring in fresh air, and that air will run through a heat exchanger, which essentially it simultaneously brings in fresh air and exhausts the stale air, and helps to preheat or pre-cool the fresh air with the exhausting air. And these are called heat recovery ventilators or energy recovery ventilators. It's basically it's a fairly simple device. It's a fan that is designed to bring in fresh air when a building is tight enough to require it. And I think that would be the best way to describe it. So it could be that that's what is called for in your new home. And the only way to know is to test, because, when a home performance blower door test is done, you'll find out what the air exchange is for your home. You know, how much leaking is just happening by virtue of the seals around windows and doors allowing a little bit of air to come in. And then often a typically built home will have quite a bit of other leakage that occurs. And if that leakage is high enough to not be a concern for the health of the occupants in the home, then nothing will likely need to be done. But we're looking for a particular amount of fresh air that is considered to be healthy. And I think Emily can speak a little bit more to the specific amounts that we're targeting there.
Yeah, Emily?
Right. So typically we're looking for a single occupancy unit of a natural leakage rate of about 1,300 CFM. So what that means is, for you, is if we do not meet that target, we want to add makeup ventilation. And either in the form that Chad was speaking of installing something like an HRV, installing something that's inherent to your HVAC system, or doing it with mechanical ventilation fans. That can be kitchen exhausts, and that can be bathroom fans. And the big question is what the existing heating system is. If we have a ducted heating system for your electric heat, then it's a lot easier for us to consider something like an HRV, because it will be natural to install that in the system. When we have something like baseboard, we tend to look more at installing exhaust fans to make sure that we have enough fresh air for healthy indoor air quality.
Hmm. Linda, do you know what kind of system you have?
Well, this is a third floor that is being fixed up, so there's going to be, I think, probably three of those square things that you put on the wall that are electric heaters.
Ah, okay.
But it's very tight, because I was up there without any, there's no heat up there right now, and it was actually quite warm, so it's got to be pretty tight. And I'm just wondering if you could do it just for one apartment or one room, or is the fan from the kitchen and the bathroom, is that enough?
Hmm. So we don't know until we test. The big question is, so we're able to quantitatively go in there and determine exactly how tight it is. And then what I also do in tandem with that is measure the existing exhaust fans and make sure that they are, first of all, performing. Occasionally we have exhaust fans that are disconnected or the motor is broken. So we believe that they're serving as ventilation, but we don't know until we test them. So I would run those numbers to ensure that it was indeed adequate, and if not, we would look at upgrading those and making sure.
Good luck, Linda. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. We'll give Neil in Shattuck a chance to join in now. Neil, what's on your mind?
Hi, guys. We built a new home this past summer, fall, and I just thought I'd bring up energy efficiency and how important it is. We built our house. Our house was the first house in the state of Wisconsin to use this, but it was called a T-stud, T-stud, like a tango-stud. And I don't know if you guys have heard of it or not. It's two 2x3s that are face-to-face, separated by 2.5 inches, and they have a dowel truss arrangement in between to hold them apart. And then that space is filled with high-density foam. So there's essentially no transfer of thermal transfer between the inside and outside. So instead of a 6.8 value for a stud, this is about 19.8. And we spray foamed the house, which, you know, was kind of expensive, but it not only gave us great R value in the wall, but also sealed up any air leaks that would be possible. And I also built boxes for the can lights in the attic, and we sprayed around all of them, including the wall penetrations. And so it's 3,400 square foot house, and it looks like it's going to cost. And we're on propane. Looks like it's going to cost about $500 from November 1st or so until at least now to heat my whole house with four people in it. So triple pane windows out of Winnipeg that are fiberglass and also have foam in the sashes and the frames. So, you know, the long-term delta on the payoff is very good on putting money into especially a new home, but even an older home if there's a, you know, cost-effective way of doing that.
Yeah.
That sounds like a great project and a great house.
Yeah, it really, really does. And there's, of course, those are, as Neil was saying, those are expensive up front, but there's a pretty good payback down the road. And in his case, it sounded like it wasn't going to be that long. Propane is probably one of the more expensive gases to use, and to go from November to now for $500 on a house that size sounds pretty good to me, Emily.
Yes, that's incredibly sweet, and you are correct. Propane is up there just behind heating oil in terms of how expensive it is to heat your home, so there's certainly a quicker payoff with that than there is with natural gas. And congratulations on the new home, and also, you know, I have to thank you for considering energy-efficient measures while you were building and going above and beyond. It's near and dear to my heart, and I just love projects like that.
Yeah, thanks, Neil. Appreciate it very much. Tom in Grant County up next. Hi, Tom.
Good morning, I guess, yet. Yeah. I have. We have an old farmhouse, and they put a lean-to on for an addition kitchen, which is a pretty flat roof. And we had seamless tin put on a few years ago. And as that water runs off to the edge of the tin, it forms an ice dam. Well, then it backs up and it seeps up over that seam, and then we get water inside the house. Is there anything I can do to keep that from freezing out there on that edge?
Yeah, so this is a great question, Tom. Thanks for calling in with this, because it sounds like part of the problem is the pitch of the roof. I think you described it as a very low pitch on that metal roof. Is that correct?
Yes.
Yeah, and so, you know, one of the things about water, and I this gives me an opportunity to kind of revise something I said earlier, because I mentioned that gravity will, you know, generally take water off a roof, but water is also, hydrostatic pressure will actually allow water in certain circumstances to go uphill, and it particularly will wick up certain materials. And The other factor that plays into water getting into homes is, of course, the wind that can be blowing while the water is moving around on a house. And so the wind will take it right back up the roof on the underside as it comes off the edge, and then it wants to get into the structure. And so one of the things that can be done that will potentially help solve the problem is to make sure that there are proper drip guards on the edge of that roof that will essentially prevent that water from being able to wick back into the structure. It might involve, you know, adding some metal flashing at the bottom on the underside and sealing it up to prevent this path from happening. The other thing that you can do, and it's generally the last resort, but sometimes ice dams simply happen if all the other things have been addressed with respect to heat and proper flashing and sealing. Sometimes we do have to resort to putting some heat tape in the problem area to make sure that the ice is melting and able to leave that area without causing these sorts of problems. But generally, putting in the heat tape is an absolute last resort. We want to be able to anticipate these various paths that the wind and the rain and the melt will cause and just keep it from getting in there. I suspect that's what's happening. The wind is driving the water back underneath that roof lip and getting into the structure.
Mm. You know, Linda had emailed to ask about deploying heat tape. What's the best way to deploy it to prevent ice dams?
Well, you know, so heat tape is essentially just an electric wire, a copper wire that's encased, and it is installed up on the edge of the roof wherever the ice dam is a persistent problem, and it's plugged in, and it literally is melting the ice by virtue of being a wire with resistance in it, and that heat is given off, and it melts it and allows it to drain down. And so often a properly functioning heat tape solution involves not just melting the snow and ice up on the roof, but putting that heat tape into the gutter, if there is one, and the downspout. Because, you know, if you're melting water and it's below freezing, it's going to freeze again and potentially dam within the gutter or within the downspout, and you're not going to end up solving the problem.
Yeah.
So typically, and it's also true that often the outlet where this gets plugged in or the source will be, you know, best and most conveniently be down at the bottom of this entire system, so at the bottom of the downspout. And so when we have an electrician install a heat tape for our clients, often that wire is coming out down at the bottom of the downspout, and then it heads up the spout through the gutter and then up onto the roof, often in kind of a zigzag pattern right at the bottom of the eave of that roof. And so that will allow the ice and the snow to be consistently melted and taken out of harm's way down to the ground. And then, of course, you just have to keep it clear at the bottom. Wherever it's going to start to freeze again, you have to make sure that it's not going to cause a problem and start to fail.
And, Tom, thanks again for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in, too, if you have a question, a home improvement question. I hope you will. The number is 1-800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or email us at ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. We'll get you on pretty quickly. I know we also wanted to talk about the difference between air sealing and insulation on the show today, just to bring that out. Emily, can you talk with us about air sealing and what it really is?
Exactly, yes. So air sealing is especially important here in Wisconsin because we are primarily a heating climate. And what that means is, of course, hot air rises. We're paying to heat our homes. And because there's an upward pressure of this hot air, it's always looking to escape all the little gaps in our ceiling, from recessed lights to open dropped soffits, all sorts of framing penetrations within buildings. So we have this constant cycle of heat loss where our hot air is escaping into the attic, and for every cubic foot of air that leaves our home, another one is pulled in, typically through places that have negative pressures within our homes, like basements, crawl spaces, under doors. And this cycle of convective heat loss creates a feeling of draftiness within our home. So when we address air sealing, typically what we're trying to do is plug up both the top, where our heat is escaping, and also address the bottom of the home where we're getting our air pulled in from. So it's kind of a two-part dynamic way that we look at the home as a full system when we air seal.
Yeah, interesting. Steve in Wausau has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Steve.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. Two things on when you have your house re-roofed, to put that ice guard on there, do you go all the way up to the peak or just 6 or 12 feet? And if you put shingles on that are like seal-o-matics and all that, how would the water get under those?
Good question. So typically best practice on the ice and water shield is we want to put that on the entire eave and overhang, and then at least 3 feet into or beyond where the exterior walls are. So, you know, another way to say that is a house that has really large overhangs or eaves is going to need more ice and water shield on it, because we're trying to protect the roof with that adhesive underlayment where there might be the ice dam. And typically we see an ice dam on the eave overhang and then right over the exterior wall. And then often as the snow builds up and the melting and the damming builds up, it'll go a foot or two inside of that exterior wall on the roof. So typically the rule of thumb is 3 feet into the house. If you go all the way to the roof, which is sometimes necessary, that would be typically when there's a lower pitch, because shingles are really designed, the typical three-tab shingle and architectural shingle that most homes have on them that are made out of either asphalt or fiberglass, these shingles are designed typically for a 412 pitch or steeper. And once you get down to anything below a 312 pitch, you almost have to put the ice and water shield on the entire roof deck. The reason for that is that the pitch is not great enough to resist that sort of hydrostatic action where the water will defy gravity and creep back underneath whatever that roofing material is. Another thing that I would just add is that the ice and water shield and then the tar paper underlayment that is under the shingles is really what's keeping the water out of a house. And then the shingles on top of that are protecting that underlayment. And that's really how most homes and buildings are built. They're redundant. The exterior layer that we see is there to protect what's underneath it, which is actually doing the heavy lifting. So that ice and water shield and then the tar paper, are keeping our houses dry. And the other thing I'll mention is that the ice and water shields are really great material, because when you nail through it, you know, when you're applying the shingles on top of it, it seals to each one of those nails as they penetrate the sheathing, and that's why it is so effective at preventing the water from dripping into a home when there is an ice dam.
Oh, really? Thanks very much, Steve, for calling. Appreciate your call. Taking a look at home improvement today with our two guests, Chad Spade. He owns Chad's Design Build. Emily Millar is president of Steady State Building Performance. She's a BPI certified home energy assessor. I'm Larry Miller. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Taking a look at your home today and home improvement issues with Chad Spade of Chad's Design Build, Emily Millar of Steady State Building Performance. She's a certified home energy assessor. Great to have both of them with us. And lots of callers online, so I think we'll just go right back to the phones. And Brian in St. Paul, Minnesota, your turn. Hi, Brian.
Hi, good afternoon. Yeah, I'm driving a semi-truck, so I just need to know we're in the country, can't burn wood. We have electric furnace. The power went out 8 days last year. We want to install, what would we install? A propane 33,000 BTU furnace for 600 square feet area, or would you recommend economically what can we install for heat that doesn't require electricity?
All right. Thanks a lot for that call. So 600 square foot home, and it's electric heat, and he wants to convert to propane because he's out in the country and natural gas wouldn't work.
Yeah, well, that, you know, I would have to say that because we do all of our work pretty much in the city, it's a great question, and I don't have a good answer off the top of my head on what I would recommend. You know, there certainly I'm a big fan of solar, but that requires batteries to be, and it also in Wisconsin or in Minnesota, you know, you're going to have to clear those panels safely to generate power year round, clear the snow off of them. But as far as a backup generator or just having a, you know, a good, reliable, you know, mobile source, I'm not sure what I would recommend beyond propane.
Yeah, I don't know either. Emily, anything from you?
Right. I mean, the first thing you're going to want to start with is, of course, running a good manual J calculation to determine that you're installing the right size system to begin with. And in terms of a backup system, it totally depends on what the structure is. Is it being used primarily as a living space? Do we really need to keep it heated? To what degree? And so we're looking for, I want to make sure I understand the question. Are we looking for a non-electric backup system?
Brian, is that what you're looking for?
Yes, correct. We've been instructed a 33,000 BTU for 500 square feet. It'll be a radiant heat propane vented outside, or that you can buy a blower to so the radiant isn't there and it'll blow that air around your house.
Okay.
Exactly. Okay. Well, it sounds like a great system. And in terms of backup, I think it depends on what sorts of resources you have around you. I personally, from living out in the country, am a huge fan of having a backup wood system. And that's simply because in, I believe it was the winter of 2013, the local cooperatives ran out of propane during the extreme polar vortex. But because there was plenty of wood available in the area, having a wood stove was invaluable. So I think it really depends on how rural you are and what resources you have available to you in terms of the ideal backup system. I know here in Southwest Wisconsin, there's a lot of lumber available. So I would say looking at your local economy and finding an inexpensive backup option is the best course of action.
All right. There we go, Brian. Thank you for calling. Appreciate your call. And let's turn to Sherry in Madison next. Hi, Sherry.
Hi, Larry, and hi, Chad and Emily. I'm calling because I have a house that's built into a hill, so the second story is downstairs, but it's par with the ground. But it's always really, really cold, and we actually use it as living space, and my daughter's been freezing. And I'm wondering, I have a 19-year-old gas furnace, and what should I do? I don't have dual systems. What do you think? I'd like to go electric so that I could use solar, but, you know, that's fuel switching. But I don't know really what might work. I don't know that air source heat pumps work in Wisconsin. What do you think?
Well, I would start by saying that the first thing that needs to be determined is how we might better insulate the home, if in fact that is a big part of the driver. Typically, we see houses that have a lot of connection to the earth, you know, that are built into the ground, and it sounds like that's what you have. You know, there can be a lot of heat loss there from inadequate insulation and thermal isolation of the various concrete and other elements that are contacting the earth. Typical year-round underground temperature in Wisconsin is something like 55, 56 degrees, I believe, here in the southern part of the state. And so that's why when you go down into a basement of just a typical home, it often feels cooler and comfortable year-round. But it also can be a very moist environment because there is not often an adequate vapor barrier installed on that cement or concrete foundation and slab. And so you get both the moisture through it and you get the cooler temperature of the earth. What we want to do is we want to prevent the moisture from coming in, and we want to insulate so that you can better control that environment. Now, you know, I'm sure Emily can speak to this because, you know, if we test the home, we'll find out, you know, what is the actual temperature of the various surfaces that are closer to the points of contact, and how much air leakage is there, and we can do some monitoring of the humidity. And these are all things that we can do to figure out what's really going on with your home. But I would say big picture, we need to better insulate, air seal, and possibly deal with some moisture transmission in the structure itself.
Mm. Emily, exactly. Would you agree with that?
I do agree with that. And I also wanted to add that air source and ground source heat pumps, I know several installers who are having a lot of success with these units. I believe the design temp for them is about negative 10. So there's a lot of trepidation in terms of installing them. But we are seeing more and more of them because they are an increasingly viable option. And I also wanted to add another note about our earth homes. So they're wonderful because we benefit from that thermal inertia of the soil, but they also pose another problem. And as Chad was saying, they have a constant exposure year-round to, you know, 40-some degree soil. And typically, we have an incomplete thermal break. Oftentimes, it's just straight cement. We get a capillary transfer of moisture, as Chad was speaking to. And additionally, what I've seen in some earth homes is during the summertime, when we have high indoor humidity, we have a very low dew point on these concrete areas, and we get summertime condensation. So this is where the big kind of caveat comes in adding insulation to those areas, because we want to make sure that we're not causing condensation buildup behind the insulation that we're installing. It's an issue we can see a lot with basement insulation. Oftentimes, if you take it down, there's mold behind it. So it will be very critical to make sure that there's a complete vapor barrier on that before considering installing any insulation to that surface.
But that's kind of the before you get a new furnace, although a 19-year-old furnace is getting up there.
Definitely. That's long in the tooth. We tend to say in this region it's about 15, 20 years is the max for a high-efficiency condensing furnace. Is this may be an atmospheric model, though. I'm not sure if it vents with PVC or vents with a metal pipe, but it's definitely towards the end of its life and really time to consider a comprehensive new strategy for the home. And the whole idea with sizing, when we come back to that manual J calculation, is we're taking into account how much insulation the home has.
And on that note, we need to take a quick break to take a look at the news, the weather. We'll find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Network. But then we'll be back with Chad Spade of Chad's Design Build and Emily Millar of Steady State Building Performance. Stay with us. We'll be back soon. Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with my two guests, Chad Spade of Chad's Design Build and Emily Millar, president of Steady State Building Performance and a BPI certified home energy assessor. We had lots of questions about a kind of broad range of things relating to home improvement. If you have one, I hope you'll join in at 800-642-1234 or send us an email to ideas@wpr.org. Callers online, Ron in Madison has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Ron.
Hi. Two corrections. The negative 10 degrees Fahrenheit limit only applies for air source heat pumps. The really good systems, which alternately extract and dump heat energy into our soils, regoliths, and shallow groundwater, those are totally independent of the outdoor air temperature if they were designed correctly and installed. Okay, that's one. Two, the average soil temperature in Kenosha County historically has been 51 degrees, up in Vilas County 47, and it grades, you know, there's a gradation between 51 and 47 depending where you live. The higher elevation in Vilas County causes it to be colder than along the Lake Superior shoreline. That's the two corrections.
All right, thank you for calling. Let's get some comments from Chad. You got a comment?
Yes, well, I knew when I started to give soil temperatures, I was, treading into dangerous territory there. So I appreciate the caller's comments. And the one thing that I'll say about the heat pumps, and I'm sure we'll have some heating contractors maybe call in to correct the record, but some of the high-efficiency systems are more scaled to industrial or commercial use. We have found, at least with some of our vendors, that we're not able to offer a cost-effective heat pump like the one that the caller just called in about for a single-family residence. And that can be true, too, for some of the other systems that are relying on, piping into the ground for capturing that temperature that's an earth underground temperature. So, those systems are excellent in larger facilities where you can justify the expense of putting the system in. And I think, one area where maybe we could make some strides at some point in this sort of technology would be in sharing some of these resources. So, for example, we've started to see with solar panels in the city of Madison, you know, you can group together with some of your neighbors and share solar panel resources for your power. And it's that sort of thing that allows some of these higher tech solutions that are more expensive to install, if they could be shared by single family homes, then it becomes more viable. But the logistics of that, you know, it requires density and other planning that we're not currently often set up to do. But it's a great, these are things that we're all talking about and trying to figure out how do we provide better solutions to our customers.
Yeah. Ron, thanks again. Appreciate it. Nick in Milwaukee, it's your turn. Hi, Nick.
Hi. We just moved into a new house. I got three kids that drive me freaking nuts. And still in the backyard, somebody built a one-stall shed with its garage. And that's going to be my man cave to get away from everything. But my question is, what do I got to do to prep the floor for carpet? I just want to carpet half of it. I don't want to screw this up, which I probably will because I'm blonde and I'm dumb.
Are you speaking of putting carpet over a cement slab then?
Sorry, yeah, it's a cement slab. Yeah. It's a poured slab, so.
Okay.
I'm not sure what exactly. There are too many things we would need to figure out about. It sounds like it's probably just a floating slab, and so, you know, that's not a structure that's typically built to be heated.
So you've got that going for it. And putting a carpet down on a cement slab, it's pretty easy to get moisture underneath that, isn't it? Between the cement and the rug?
Absolutely, yeah. And, I mean, this sounds like a structure that's just meant for storage, for seasonal storage typically. And so, you know, anything that you would put out there would have to be exterior rated. So it would be an indoor-outdoor carpet that would be designed to withstand constant moisture exposure. And so I guess that's what I would recommend if you were going to do something like that.
You could be worried about mold and other things developing, though, if you did get that kind of situation. Emily, wouldn't you?
Oh, definitely. And it might be worthwhile to consider building kind of a floating floor, but then it just comes down to how badly you want carpet in that area. I know that there are products that I believe they're intended to be placed under rugs that are on concrete floors that are designed to protect them from moisture, but I'm not sure what their perm rating is and if they're designed to be permanent installations or designed to be used with rugs that you will periodically be removing. So what I would look for in terms of protecting that carpet from moisture is look into perm ratings, find something that is a vapor barrier, and I generally advise against placing carpeting directly on slab. When people have it in their basements, it can often be a source of mold. If anyone's suffering from asthma, I don't recommend having it there. So I'm sorry I can't give a more, no pun intended, concrete answer to the question.
So there you go, Nick. That's as good as we can do today. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. Oh, man. Dan in Merrimack, your turn. Hi, Dan.
Hey, how are you guys today?
Great. Thanks for the call.
Couple questions for Emily. You do blower door tests. Correct?
That is correct, Dan.
Do you check for vermiculite in the attics?
That's what I do first. It's my favorite thing to do. Just kidding. But yes, indeed, the first thing I have to do to set up for a blower door, well, the very first thing is I have to make sure all the combustion appliances are shut off, and then up into the attic, respirator on, and look for that vermiculite. As you know, it's pesky, it's pervasive. Wisconsin was a very large recipient of vermiculite.
Yes, you are so smart.
Well, thank you. I'll take compliments all day. I appreciate that.
Yeah, you can't do a blower door test if you've got vermiculite insulation, essentially. Isn't that right, Emily?
That's correct. Because we're depressurizing your home, we're pulling air in from the attic, and we don't want to risk that friable asbestos fiber in your breathing air. And the majority of people I find are not aware that they have vermiculite, and commonly that is because of the application. Typically it is used around chimney stacks in attics, and that's because they could pour it down in those open penetrations around fireplaces because it's a fire resistant form of insulation. So it's pesky, and I'm always bummed out when I find it.
Okay. Dan, thanks very much for calling. That's a good point to bring up. I'm glad you called.
Yes, thank you, Dan.
Bob in Rice Lake, your turn. Hi, Bob.
Well, good morning. We're remodeling our entire house, and when the weather turns, we're going to turn to the outside because it's not done right. So we're going to totally redo the whole frickin' house. But right now in the living room, there's three windows that form like a bay window.
Yep.
But there's three of them. And we're going to replace that. And my question for Chad is, do we want to take that lip off? And then what kind of windows would he recommend, like a straight plate or one with a couple of crankers on it or whatever?
Yeah, well, so Bob, that's a great question. And so a lot's going to depend on the architecture of the home, which is to say, you know, are these bay windows going to have their own roof over top of them, or do they sit under a continuous eave or overhang? You know, those will be things that will help determine what's the best way to support the cantilever of the bay window. Because I think the issue that you're really asking about is how do you make sure that over time the windows don't start to sag, which is something we see all the time, because often when a bay window is installed, it is not properly supported. The two basic ways that you would do it is either to support it from underneath, and often that's done with some sort of structural bracket. The least expensive would be a diagonal bracketing that would go back to the home, and sometimes that's enclosed with siding material so you don't actually see it, but you see the fact that there's some structure there that's enclosed. But then other times we suspend it from above, and those cables run through the entire unit down, basically wrapping around the picture window, which is typically the larger window facing out at the edge of it. And those cables come out of the top and can be attached to something structural above. And, you know, with the proper sizing of the cables and the connections, that will keep the window in place. Then, of course, the other issues that you would want to deal with when you're redoing the entire exterior of the home or just remodeling would be to make sure that the rain plane or that exterior shell of the home is going to keep water out of this new bay window. And then you want to be thoughtful about the envelope of insulation which goes around that window. You want to have the base plate properly insulated and the roof space above to be properly insulated and air sealed so that, you know, the window itself is always going to be a colder place, because even the most high-tech windows are going to have an R value of about maybe 5. So it's a hole in the wall, and you don't want to compound that cold feeling that you're going to have from all that glass with having a leaky, poorly insulated unit where there are surfaces that can be properly insulated, so that the glass and the gaskets are the only thing that you have to maintain and worry about. So did that help?
Yeah, to a certain degree it did. I was wondering whether to just take off that jut for the window, because there's nothing above it but a gutter, and just remove it and put it in flat.
I guess I would have to see that to see exactly what it is you're referring to be able to answer that better. It could be that the basic structure, if the structure itself is square, and the windows could be individually replaced, sometimes that might be appropriate if everything is in good shape.
Well, the structure that holds the window up is shot.
Oh.
Okay.
It's just junk. That's right. Why we're remodeling the whole thing. So.
Okay. So I would say it should all be torn out, and then the question of how it is connected to the house, you're going to need to have someone that, or are you planning to do the installation yourself of the windows?
Oh God, no, I just,
okay.
It's all going to be closed foam.
Okay.
Re-insulate the entire house outside with closed foam.
Okay.
For our vapor break.
So a closed foam being applied to the exterior of the home?
Yep, and in the basement, the basement wall.
Okay. Is it being sprayed into the cavities?
Well, everything's coming off the outside.
So it's going to be a sheet material that's applied?
No, they said that once we get the siding and the Tyvek and all that stuff off, pull all the old insulation out, the pink junk. He said he can just foam a closed cell, between the studs.
Okay. Yeah, well, the reason I was asking is that the one thing that we do have to be concerned about is the closed cell foam is an excellent insulator, and it's also a vapor barrier. And so we always want to make sure that when we put a vapor barrier into a wall assembly, we only have one of them. Because if you have a vapor barrier on the inside and then you apply a vapor barrier to the outside of the house, then there's the potential to trap moisture in the wall itself, and that can cause its own problems. But the approach sounds like one where they're going to be spraying that foam into the cavities, onto the backside of the interior walls. I mean, it's the exterior wall, but onto the interior material on those exterior walls. And that should provide a very effective and comfortable envelope for the home.
There you go. Thank you, Bob, very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Greg in Eau Claire has something for us. Hi, Greg.
Hello there. To make it short here, I have a 26 by 72 double wide trailer, and last fall I put a basement under it, and I laid 1,200 feet of in-floor heat tubing. I'm just trying to figure out what would be best for heating that water. I've heard mixed reviews on either doing just a regular water heater or a propane water heater, or also a tankless propane or electric.
Hmm.
You know, I Greg, I would have to talk to a couple of our HVAC specialists to really answer that question. That's not something that is a specialty for me. I don't know if Emily has any expertise on that.
Emily, what do you think?
Well, something to consider is definitely I am not a HVAC professional. I can give ideas and recommendations, but I don't do the installation, so I definitely would want someone who specialized in that to look at your particular project. However, something to consider is a combi boiler that would be a system that would not only heat your subfloor hydronic tubing, but would also provide your hot water, because then you don't have to think about standby losses for two different systems. You have it all combined into one, and it's somewhat of a new thing stateside. They've been fairly common in Europe for a while, but it's something to consider that some HVAC outfits might not be looking at yet.
All right, there we go. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. And let's see, we have David in Oak Creek. Hi, David.
Thanks for taking my call. I have ultimately a couple of questions. We have an old 1930s bungalow, and the first question is, we have no sump, so can I assume from that we have no drain tile?
Great question. So a 1930s bungalow probably doesn't have a drain tile, though, and if it had been retrofitted on the interior, you probably would have a sump. There is a possibility that someone has put in some sort of a gravity system if you live in, or if the home is in an area that, you know, has some hills and valleys, and I'm not sure, what's the topography of the area?
Yeah. Oh, we're flat.
Okay. Yeah. So it's very. So you would have to have a pump to pull water out from around the foundation. And so I would say that's a safe assumption that you do not have a drain tile.
Okay. So then I would assume the best answer would be to put in drain tile in a sump. However, as an interim, is it possible to cut a hole into the basement floor, basically create a sump there, put in a sump pump, and pump the water out as she fills up?
Well, so that, you know, in theory of just dealing with water, that might work. But the problem, there are a couple of things that we would have to make sure are true for that to be a safe thing. One is that we need to make sure that you don't have radon in the soil at your home. And when you cut that hole in the ground, you're going to be connecting the interior air to the soil, and that's how radon gets into a home. So if you had a really reasonably well-maintained foundation right now without many cracks in it, you might have radon around your home, but not really getting much in the home. And once you put a hole in the ground, you're changing that. So you have to test for radon. And I wouldn't generally consider that to be a good long-term solution, to just have a hole or a pit in the basement to pump water out of. But a sump pit could be installed with a pump, and you could seal it up properly. And you could collect water initially and see how that works.
And at that point, we are out of time. Oh, man. Chad, Emily, thank you both so much for being with us today. I really appreciate it. Chad, you're back on my birthday, May 14th. Thank you for being with us. Chad Spade of Chad's Design Build. Emily Millar of Steady State Building Performance. Great to have them with us. And thank you for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store here on the Ideas Network.